With your permission, we'd like to talk shop for just a moment.
Because we've got a good racket going, you're not going to be able to touch our own.
Oh, okay, so you've got a racket going.
Cookies are not the only food. I tell that to my children all the time.
It's time for the publisher fight. It's time for the publisher fight.
Here's a man that really appreciates that new England pound.
Hi, how's it going, and welcome to the Video Week podcast. My name is Vincent Flood. I'm the editor-in-chief at Video Week, and in this episode, I'm speaking to David Pollitt, CEO at Incremental, a company that specializes in retail media measurement. One of my big takeaways from Cannes, when speaking to brands and agencies particularly, was that whilst they're very excited about retail media, they felt that its growth was being limited by a combination of fragmentation, a lack of standardization, especially when you have to deal with, you know, a new retailer every other week who's launching a new service, and then the lack of measurement, particularly around, you know, transparency and what was actually happening is a major, I repeat, major problem. Also, there was a feeling that commerce media, for in order for it to take off, and just to clarify what I mean by commerce media, I'm referring to the use of retailer data to deliver ads off a retailer's site, so it might be with a broadcaster or to run ads on publishers. There was a feeling that many publishers, I think broadcasters are doing a slightly better job, but need to get their clean room strategies sorted. The cookies are going away, as we all know, and if they're going to take advantage of the opportunities ahead, they really need to get their house in order. Okay, before we go into the conversation, I'll just give you a bit of an update on what we've got coming up with Video Week. We are taking a little bit of a break over the summer, but we are hitting into September with a bit of a bang. We will have Video Week Cologne, it's a half-day conference the day before Demexco. So if you're going to Demexco in September and you haven't booked your tickets, make sure you book early enough that you can come to along to Video Week Cologne the day before, which is a half-day event at the Radisson Blu. Then we've also got the European Video Awards ceremony in London shortly afterwards on September 26th. Then we will be off to San Sebastian in early October for TV Rise. That TV Rise is a CTV leadership forum. If you are a leader in the CTV space, you should be there. It is my favorite of all our events. It's the one where I learn more than at any other event. I think that's because of the spirit of openness that we have at the event. I feel like you get the inside track on what's happening in the industry, and you also get a chance to make a lot of great industry friends along the way. It really is an unmissable one if you are involved in CTV. Right now, I'll cross over to my conversation with David, and I hope you enjoy. So, David, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me, Vincent.
So, we normally kick things off with a little bit of background on the person. It's always good to hear about their journey. I'm curious about the path that your career took before you became CEO of Incremental, which we'll get into in a minute.
Yeah. I think the easiest way to say it is all but 5 years of my career were my salary was VC funded, right? I've pretty much been a startup, guy all of my life. I've been on both sides of the aisle. I've run digital for LendingTree. The 5 years where I wasn't VC funded was Bank of America, where I ran digital, and mostly, I've spent my career selling digital advertising or technology that enables marketers to make smarter decisions.
Yeah. With Incremental, what's the problem? Why does Incremental exist?
Yeah. Well, I love that question because, it's always great to be passionate about what you're working on. And with Incremental, we exist because retail media popped up really, really fast and got incredibly big, right? It is, it grew to $50 billion faster than search or social, for example. And during that growth, you watched a maturity curve, and it looked to me like measurement fell way behind on the maturity curve, given the investment that goes in. The lion's share of retail media today, we are a retail media measurement solution, and specifically one that is neutral. We have no financial incentive to, you know, report the performance of one media type better than another media type. And we saw need for that, right? So you had about $50 billion changing hands in the vast, vast majority of the performance reporting was provided by the recipient of those ad dollars. And while they have unique and differentiated data that positions them well to provide good reporting, we believe that brands have voted in almost every medium. Eventually, a neutral measurement provider has come out of the fray to help brands confidently make decisions about where to put their dollars and to predict what to expect from those investments.
So how do you go about that? I mean, what's the, give us a use case?
Yeah. So, I mean, first of all, we work very hard to get away from coincidence and to get to causality. And by that, I mean, you know, the system is working very hard to say, yeah, Vincent was exposed to this ad on the way to purchase that product, but Vincent already intended to purchase that product. And so therefore this ad does not receive credit for driving an incremental sale. It made no contribution to that sale. And to the positive, we look to identify the media investments or the campaigns or the components of retail media, the promotional activity, the pricing, all of the different dimensions. We try to understand what's truly compelling consumers that would not otherwise have purchased this product or from this brand to do so. And we call that incremental sales. To get to your methodology, certainly to provide ubiquity across the walled gardens, we have some probabilistic methodologies that look like but are far from identical to traditional econometrics. But we also have developed a pretty unique approach to doing what we call synthetic testing. And the reason why we do synthetic testing is in a lot of retail media, you can't do holdouts or control groups. So to get to causality, you have to sort of synthesize a control group without the ability to say serve a placebo or, you know, hold out Philadelphia to see, you know, the purchase patterns of consumers not exposed to ads. We pull that all together into, you know, a SaaS platform that actually goes through about 25,000 variations of a model every hour. And right now today we produce daily results, so daily scoring of incrementality at the campaign level for retail media.
So how effective is closed attribution? I mean, the big promise of retail media is, you know, the closed loop. How effective, you know, is that working today? And, I say that partly after having a few conversations with brands and agencies in Cannes who are very excited about retail media, see it as being, you know, they can undoubtedly see, you know, further growth. But they had lots of concerns around the teething troubles, particularly in a European context where the market isn't quite so mature. But I don't think it's exclusively a European problem either. But yet, this holy grail of closed attribution, I mean, how effective is it, do you think?
Yeah. So, I mean, one of the things that I think you have to know is that closed loop is exciting in the sense that brands are getting access to, you know, purchases, and they're getting an association between the ads being delivered and the consumer making a purchase. And that, so that's exciting. It's a data asset that, for example, CPGs have always wanted to unlock in their retail partnerships. But to believe that it is the solution to media measurement would require you, because it's an entirely walled garden, it would require you to take the leap of faith that when a consumer buys on Amazon or Walmart, only the ads delivered by Amazon or Walmart contributed to that outcome, right? because the closed loop basically says, these are the ads you bought through Walmart, and these are the purchases that were made by consumers through Walmart. The reality is the consumer journey cuts across retailers. The consumer journey interacts with CTV and interacts with out-of-home, digital out-of-home, in-store shopper marketing, macroeconomics, in some cases, even large natural disasters drive a shift in channel from a purchasing perspective. So is closed loop an interesting component of measurement? 100%. Should that be the approach? Should you go just to each retailer one by one to determine the efficacy of their media and understand the appropriate mix of investment across retailers? Absolutely not. It is equivalent of saying that you are going to predict the weather, but knowing only today's temperature, right? It's just not a complete data set or methodology, and not one that maps back to how consumers interact with products.
I mean, is it working? Is it effective, do you think? Or is there, and I say this partly having spoken to people who didn't feel the attribution was effective or accurate.
No. All right. So one of the largest brands in the world has a skincare division. I can't say their name. I have yet to get a client that gives me rights to say their brand name publicly, right? Although we are going to do something on a stage in the future, so y'all can guess it later. But that skincare brand has an attribution model from Amazon. Taking a look at the total sales on Amazon and taking a look at the attribution that Amazon retail media is claiming credit for as it relates to those sales, they're claiming greater than 99% of the sales are occurring as a result of the advertising. You just don't need a PhD in statistics to determine that that's not a realistic measurement and attribution solution. The other reason it's not working, though, is even more basic. The way that Instacart attributes ad interactions to sales is different than how Walmart does it, which is different than how Amazon does it. So imagine that you wanted to just put the performance reporting across all these retailers together. Forget it, get back getting to true incrementality. Even then, advertisers don't have a common lens on performance because the math is different retailer to retailer, RMN to RMN. There's no consistent approach beyond us that I know of that puts a common lens on the measurement of retail media. And that's problematic for advertisers. At the end of the day, the brands are looking to optimize their media investment across all of the opportunities that they have to make an investment. And what this really promises or attempts to do, and I don't think it does a great job of it, it attempts to help you optimize your existing spend within the existing retailer that it rests with. It just doesn't solve for the media problem. The last thing that I'd say is when you have coincidence-based attribution, it actually tends to favor the non-incremental. And what I mean by that is the placement that is going to perform best on any given retailer is when they come in and they search for that specific brand or that specific product and the ad delivers to them, right? So when you look at the reporting, you're going to go, that's our best performing unit. But it's really not. Those people are probably buying your product again and again and again, and they did not need exposure to an ad to make that purchase again. I mean, shoot, the intent is sitting right there in the search. They searched the product by name. And so does that mean that that aspect of retail media is, of no value? Definitely not. There's actually a lot of value there. You certainly don't want your greatest competitor to be there conquesting those consumers. So there's value to being on it, but that's merchandising. It's not actually media. And so I think you really have to make a distinction between what retail media types are more akin to merchandising and what retail media types should be measured as and are more closely aligned to traditional media.
I'll say this conversation very much reminds me of the early days of display where, last click or even last view, often for ads that weren't even in view, were claiming credit for sales.
Let me tell you a story about that. I'm sorry I interrupted you.
No, perfect, please do.
Right? Do you know how DSPs used to win bake-offs?
I don't, or I might, but
right. So it used to be they bake you off, right? Which was crazy because the programmatic universe wasn't that big, especially once you were sort of, you know, had a good methodology for ensuring your ads delivered on desirable sites, right? So they'd run a couple of DSPs at the same time and see who drives the lowest CPA. More often than not, ads from different DSPs were showing up on the same page. So who wins? The person who is below the fold. Because the page paints, the DOM paints the page from the top to the bottom. The last cookie to trigger is the ad that was least likely to ever be viewed by the consumer, right? It's a really good parallel. When you have that kind of measurement, the worst, you know, the worst producing ads tend to surface to the top and be presented as the best performing ads. One of the things we talk to our clients about a lot is, listen, if you continue down this approach to measurement, you're not missing out on opportunities for growth. You are likely optimizing away from incremental growth, away from top line growth. The only thing improving are the vanity metrics provided to you by the recipients of the ad dollars.
And I mean, obviously in going about this, I mean, you can understand marketers' desire for attribution. But it feels like we're into one of my favorite industry themes, which is misaligned incentives, which I think explain much of the industry's problems. You know, our marketers just, why do they accept this nonsense? Is it that they haven't really thought it through or have that awareness of the bigger picture? Is it just easier to chuck these stats into a PowerPoint and justify your spend to this CMO? Why do people put up with, you know, such inadequate measurement? And not just in retail media, this is an industry problem across the board that I hear time and time again of people just accepting, you know, a vendor's numbers, even when that vendor has been caught time and time again misleading people.
Yeah. I mean, first, one thing I want to say is I don't think anyone's intentionally misleading anyone. Mm. I think that it's really hard to build really good measurement, especially on a new media type, and especially when to do it, you have to have a view across Walmart, Target, and Amazon, and the three of them are never going to share data, right? So I want to be clear, it's less about the intention of the recipient of the ad dollars. It's just more about the fact that retail media exploded, right? And if you ask me today, sans our own measurement, which we're really proud of, what is the best measurement in space? The next up is Amazon. The next up is Walmart. They've built incredible tools and they've done their best to provide the measurement that they can on the data set they have access to for their advertisers. The reality is it's incomplete, right? You need a solution that looks across all of the touch points or as many as you can get your hands on and get into your model and model statistically soundly of the consumer pathways and journeys to the product purchase, right? So the other thing that I would say is unique to retail media is that closed loop thing where there's problems with it. And I think it sometimes presents a few red herrings. It's also got a ton of really rich data. There's really interesting data about, you know, the combination of SKUs that consumers buy that are predictive of another purchase. Consumers' response to promotions, even promotions that occur on other retailers and how that changes the performance on this retailer, which obviously the advertisers have to bring that insight in, but they can model things that they've never been able to model. And, you know, it's a better universe. It's an imperfect universe is how I like to look at it. And what we're trying to do is go on the journey with everyone to make it better, right? To raise the game on the measurement side.
And I should stress that I wasn't referring to any specific retailers, thinking more about other platforms and people just, there being an acceptance sometimes of unverified numbers in the industry. But you know, what is this? I think we need to be quite careful with what we're talking about. Let's talk about on-site retail media, by which we mean, you know, ads served in typically an e-commerce environment. I mean, what role are those ads playing in the marketer's media mix? I'm curious about what you think that type of media is competing with and what is it displacing?
Yeah, I mean, boy, that's a big answer. What is it displacing? Forget about the ad dollars for a second. And we're going to talk about this later, I hope at least, how the pandemic just drove e-commerce through into the sky, right? It became a very meaningful percentage of most brand sales, meaningful enough to justify a seat at the executive table, right? It, much in the same way that it drove CTV. When you talk about displacing, sometimes it's shifting. A lot of retail media is just good placement on the shelf, at least the on-site. It's not exclusively that, and we could talk about this topic for hours, but it, to simplify it, you know, consumers are looking for products and you are presenting yourself in an area where they've already indicated some intent to buy a product akin to the one that you're trying to sell, and you can pay up to have more premium placements in that consideration, right? It has price, it has the opportunity for promotions, and it is sitting next to competitive offers. So in many ways, it really is the digital shelf. Some of it's paid, some of it's organic, but the combination of it is ultimately a digital shelf, right? There are also ads that are less search-based that run throughout the retailer's website, and they're different, right? You use different targeting mechanisms. They have different goals and tactics. But at the end of the day, the lion's share of the investment right now is to filling out the premium spots within a new shelf. And the displacement is the consumers that have moved from purchasing offline to gaining more comfort in purchasing online more regularly. From an advertising perspective, the dollars are coming out of the shopper marketing. The dollars are coming from other media types. The dollars are flowing in from a number of places. And a lot of the retail media investment right now is driven as part of their JVPs, which is you know, the partnership negotiations between the merchants who sell products at the retailers and the retailers themselves. So retail media will be bundled in to a much larger deal, right? And so I think that also grew, you know, drove a lot of the growth of retail media, is that it wasn't, you know, digital display, you know, sales reps dialing for dollars. It was injected right into the largest, most impactful and meaningful negotiations and discussions that occur between retailers and merchandisers.
For me, it's very self-evident that retail media is a very obvious thing that a major brand should be doing, should be investing in. And you can see how it, you know, is assuming the price is right, it's going to work. But from the retailer's point of view, I mean, are we going through a little bit of a honeymoon period in that, you know, they've had this sort of greenfield inventory, basically, where there's lots of low-hanging fruit, they can sort of sell to their existing partners, probably get some incremental revenue from some of their competitors. But are we going to hit a buffer? You know, where do you think the future growth is going to come from for retailers?
Yeah, I mean, a couple of things. One, it's definitely a honeymoon for them in the sense that it's very high margin in comparison to the other solutions that they bring to market. You know, it's a really, really great, great addition to their business models. Number two, I do think, you know, you pointed out we did sort of start on the negative. It is the greatest targeting unlock that has occurred in the space, right? This is the unlocking of first party data and very specifically past purchases. So you have intent layered into this first party data that is being unlocked, undeniably the gold standard of data that you could use for the targeting and optimization of your media. I mean, honestly, a lot of people are sad about the deprecation of the cookie. In the past life, I've sat in identity and I've sat in DMPs and I've seen the accuracy of the data and even the confidence of the attachment of that data to cookies and maids. This is so much better and cleaner and richer. So it's a wonderful thing that is going on from a targeting and optimization perspective, right? Where I think the buck stops is if you look at the growth projections for retail media, if you believe, for example, the Barclays analyst report that they put out a few months ago, it's got a long way to go. It is still in hockey stick. It's going to become massive. To do that, two things are going to have to happen. Number one, more investment is going to have to occur in what we consider to be offsite retail media, which is, some people call it commerce media, but it's ultimately either ad types that have transaction opportunities within them. You've probably seen those on like Instagram, TikTok. You know, there are a number of providers that are now providing an opportunity for you to transact in their ads, or it's the retailers allowing that data to be syndicated out to other media types like CTV, right? So when you do that and you combine that with this massive increase in the scale of the budget, you're going to have to move from marketing vanity metrics to measurement that the finance department will accept. And it's happened everywhere. We've seen these parallels. Think about, you know, the old days. When I was at LendingTree, Yahoo used to RFP us. Think about that. How many millions of dollars would you pay to be in the loan center? Mm-hmm. Right? Because digital was hot. It was a big deal. It was pre-April 2001. And everyone believed it was going to disrupt every single industry, and that all the power was going to sit within the portals. Right now, a lot of the power sits within the retailers, but as those budgets creep up, you know, the consideration that merchants give to the investment is also going to tighten. And so I think that, you know, the ultimate outcome here, and I see a lot of retailers working very hard to satisfy this demand, but is going to be for better, more reliable measurement that is mired more in the P&L, that focuses more on top line sales and less on claiming credit down in the marketing vanity metric areas.
I mean, search is an obvious target. For retailers in terms of when they're, you know, going out looking for budgets. Search was always the intent base, bottom of the funnel, you know, but I feel like the retailers are another step further down right at that, you know, transactional moment. Are you seeing people shifting search budgets across? Is that something that's happening, or is search just seen as an addition to retail media, do you think?
Gosh, that's a good question. I don't know that I know the answer to that. What I can tell you, that search is often undercredited in the attribution provided by the retail media providers, right? So when we run our models, we actually suck in your Google data, we suck in your Facebook, your TikTok, a whole bunch of stuff, right? And one of the things we often talk about is, hey, this is actually working really well, right? Your investment in traditional search is driving a lot of demand, getting people to the retailers' websites, and then the retail media is making the ultimate conversion. It's not always the case. A lot of people type in Amazon.com and get going. And in that way, I think your point is 100% true. What I don't know is whether or not brands are robbing the search media budget, or whether or not the budget dollars are coming from other places and funding what you could almost call a new type of search. Do you know what I mean? For the on-site media. I don't know the answer.
And when it comes to, you know, the off-site stuff, I mean, where do you think most of the money is going? You know, where are they looking to spend? You know, is it about using it to sort of, you know, inform essentially a new version of display retargeting campaigns or something similar? Or, you know, are they more attracted to brand-focused media like TV or video?
They're heading there. There's a lot of talk, right? First what I'd say is the initial off-site, like if you look at the real investments that were going on, Amazon has a DSP, it's very effective, super smart people run it. And so that enables people to go off and programmatically target against, you know, some version of, you know, past purchase data, assemble up audiences and target them programmatically. And there are other examples of that. Target has their own solution. Walmart's got some really good and interesting stuff. But, you know, like, forget about the media type for a second and think about the objective that you just asked about. I think this is super important. To date, you talk about closed loop, you talk about targeting, you talk about replacing search. That's all bottom of the funnel, right? So it's reductionist. Maybe I can convert a few more people. Like, let's move it to the physical sphere for a second. Maybe I can convert a few more people that have already walked into the store to my brand or my product. Is that valuable? 100%. Is that a growth strategy for a multinational CPG? Absolutely not. It has to move upstream. And at the same time that retail media is exploding, and I would argue triggered in part by the pandemic, so was CTV, right? And there's a lot of talk about it. I haven't seen as much transactionally occur, but I believe it will, where you're going to see retail data targeting CTV, and the marriage makes so much sense. Because when you think about CTV, at least in the authenticated space, you have a massive reduction in ad loads. So you have a need to serve more impactful placements so that you can justify the spend, right? So interests are aligned between CTV and retail media providers. The missing piece is video is super impactful. Not, you know, yeah, you can do some direct response and it works better than it ever did in the past because we've moved from, you know, buying units to buying impressions. And I think that's really cool and helpful. And it brings a lot of the capabilities from programmatic along, although I think there's a lot of work yet to be done there. But what's always been interesting about video is it can connect on an emotional level. It can communicate with consumers a different way. And if you think of the baseline laws of marketing that have never changed, you know, the mind tends to justify what the heart desires, right? And so if you really want to create new demand, one of the best places you can look to is video-based advertising. And so this marriage, as it shakes out, and as the execution of it, not the academic matching of these data assets to this inventory, but actually the execution, the steps that advertisers have to take to enable it, as those rails get ironed out and become simpler to leverage, I think it's going to be beautiful. And I think retail media will start to have an impact on real at-scale demand generation on behalf of CTVs. And I also think that first-party data, and specifically first-party data that is mired in past transactions, will effectively replace all of the behavioral intent data that is basically under siege with the deprecation of the cookie and privacy, right? And it's a good thing because it's better data. It's more accurate. The behaviors that you exhibit that are then intention is inferred typically involve you using a credit card to make a purchase. That's a hell of a lot better than, you know, red, you know, Mary Claire, so must be female, right? That's a pretty bad proxy for determining something interesting about a person. This is really good data, and I think it's going to be amazing. I also think brands, the people who transact, they're going to have to look to their partners within the organization that know a lot about brand metrics, that know about how to measure placements that are as effective at driving brand or perhaps more effective than they are at driving immediate conversions. Those disciplines are going to have to merge. That was a mouthful, but it's something we're thinking a lot about, right? We're very excited about it and unraveling how to measure it and how to move up the chain from a purely direct response focused approach. I think it's going to be interesting and a journey we're all going to go on together as an industry.
Is there a place for on-site video, do you think, within the retail environment, or is it too interruptive? Or, you know, I have been speaking to some of the companies that are more involved on the the activation side of things, and they said that's something that they're very keen to do and to grow, but it's all about getting the format right. But is that something you're seeing on site at this point?
Yeah, I mean, there is some. Absolutely. If you go to the carousels on some of the providers, you know, you get to see, I want an ego blower, and oh my gosh, that's what 700 CFN looks like, right? Mm-hmm. So you can, there's definitely instances where video is leveraged. But again, it's presented in a different way because it's if not a different medium, it's a different advertising type, right?
Yeah.
And it nests itself in a way that it often wants to look like the content, not like the ad.
Yeah, so, as it should, I think. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think it's so in terms of the agencies and how they're responding to retail media, I mean, it's a beautiful relationship for the average agency where they can have a client who maybe they're doing their, you know, media buying creative for, then they also might be selling their media to their other clients. So it's there's a lot of opportunity there for agencies, which I think is why a lot of the agencies have been going in so hard on it. How do you think that they can balance these relationships, you know, particularly when they're sort of building their own products and around it, and how can they sort of balance kind of, yeah, having this intermediary role alongside serving their clients' interests?
Yeah. Well, here comes the self-serving plug. I think that they need a neutral measurement partner because, well, there are a lot of phenomenal agencies that provide tremendous value for their clients in any number of ways. At the end of the day, their financial incentives are to represent the quality of the media that they purchased and invested in as positively as they can. And what we're seeing is, you know, agencies have matured throughout this entire journey, you know, into digital. And for every agency that says, no, we have to control all the measurement for any of the media that we source on behalf of our clients, there are other agencies and even large holdcos that actually have said, there's no such thing as, you know, white labeling ad tech and presenting it as my platform. We are going to very crisply and clearly leverage the fact that you are a neutral measurement partner. And we are going to lean into the story that, hey, when they're here, your vanity metrics might look a little worse, but your top line sales are going to grow significantly. So, you know, we've confronted sort of two schools of thought. Some of it is sort of age old protectionism, but more and more we're experiencing, you know, a phenomenal relationship with agencies because it's great for them to have a neutral third party represent the great work that they're doing on behalf of their clients. I do think they're all enthusiastically chasing retail media, in part because that's where the dollars are moving. And if you're an agency, it's a no-brainer to build out a practice around that. I think that a lot of agencies have learned that it's harder. Right. So the president of one holdco, and not one that I'm currently at least publicly working with, so AKA not our global deal with WPP, a different president, you know, said to me, listen, when you move a dollar from TV into retail media, I have 10x the service hours to invest against it to bring it to life and make it work, but I get paid the same. So I do think, you know, the agencies that have technology or that are assembling and integrating in unique and differentiated ways, best of class technologies to help reduce the reliance on arms and legs are going to be the winners, right? We're obviously very keen on the ones that have partnered with us, and not simply because they're sending checks to our door. I think their strategy's killer, right? You know, they're taking the assets that they have, the expertise that they have, and injecting it into a collection of best of breed vendors to build something that you could only get through that holdco. And we're talking to other agencies and holdcos about different strategies that are equally as smart. It'll be really fun to see these strategies play out and to see which ones work best on behalf of brands.
Yeah, it has been absolutely fascinating to see how they're all approaching it. When it comes to, you know, AI is obviously something that we've all been talking about in Cannes, and I'm just curious about the role that it has to play. Is there anything interesting happening in the retail media world, or are you seeing anything emerge on that front yet?
Yeah, I mean, look, I think the best stuff is coming out of the likely folks. Like Amazon has put real AI to play and provided tools that, you know, improve outcomes for brands and reduce the hours it takes to produce them. So they've had some good announcements, and I think high value solutions they've brought to market. There's also a lot of just fluff out there. LLMs are the magic elixir. I mean, I don't know if our audience is old enough to know Josie Wales, but there was the guy that sold the magic elixir that, you know, could fix anything, including get stains out of your shirts, right? LLMs, they're really good at pattern recognition, right? And they're great at memorization. They're not there yet on reasoning. So when you're confronted with a pitch where someone says, hey, we're using an LLM, we're using this form of AI, and it's going to replace all the service hours and do everything much faster, retail media is too complex. It's too interconnected. Do I believe it'll get there? 100%. But I don't think the technology's there yet, right? The decisions are not alike to each other enough to unleash and, you know, on the loop, meaning like you're not in there governing the decisions that are recommended by the AI and let it run on its own. It's just not there. They don't reason very well yet. Now, who knows what ChatGPT 5.0 will look like? I love the little models that, you know, frankly, Meta is spinning out. There's some really cool stuff. So we'll get there, but it's not there yet. And if you're hearing that, then I think you should look at it with a suspicious eye if it's not presented to you as vision, but rather it's presented to you as reality. Because I haven't seen that yet, right, in retail media planning and buying.
Yeah, I mean, in your last two answers, you sort of referred to the amount of work and hours that have to be put into this. And that's a recurring theme that I've heard before, you know, the age-old problem with fragmentation, but it seems to be 10x the fragmentation that we have in other media types because, like you say, these different retailers are operating in such different ways. I mean, is there any hope that we're going to see a unified DSP like experience of being able to buy different types of media, or you know, even the DSP world is far from perfect in terms of what you can do and where you can buy. But I'm curious about this retail media activation layer. What type of products are coming to market? Is there anything that promises to unify everything, or is the infrastructure just too messy and fragmented and built differently that there's no real, it's lacking coherence?
You know what? There are 220 RMNs now, right? I don't know how many there were 5 years ago, but it was a smidgen in comparison to how many they are now. And you're right, the retailers are all pursuing the walled garden experience. And the reality is add dollars flow to areas where you can buy things at a certain level, a certain volume, right, of consumers or impressions. There has to be scale. Do I think that we'll ever have a perfect environment where, you know, Kroger, Albertsons, Amazon, Target, and Walmart inventory all sits together in a centralized environment to be decisioned by algorithms? Definitely not. It's not how the business relationships work. And some of the very large ones don't have a compelling reason to abandon their walled garden strategy. But there's a very, very long tail that is assuming that their data asset and access to their inventory is valuable enough for brands and the agencies that they hire to field a team that can one-to-one go place out and manage this advertising across this super large and long tail of RMNs. And it's just not going to happen, right? We've seen that in every other media type. I'm not trying to pick on media planners, but it's pretty well proven that, you know, the best sales strategy for selling media is make it easy to buy. And so do I know how it will consolidate, how it'll all get rolled up? I honestly don't. Will they ever standardize presentation and then therefore be able to centralize inventory? A lot of barriers to that and a lot of reasons against it. But if they want to survive and continue to capitalize on this super high margin, some of those problems are going to have to get solved. If you're the smaller end of an RMN, you're either going to combine forces with other, or you're just not going to generate that much revenue because there's not that much motivation to engage with you. Too much work, way too little lemon juice.
I'm slightly embarrassed to really. I just realized that we haven't really talked about the consumer yet, and should probably touch on them. I mean, do you think the consumers know that how their data is used? Do you think they're interested? Do they care? Do you think it's simply anonymized to the degree now where it's a non-issue?
I mean, no major player yet has opted to weaponize privacy in an effort to attack retail media. Privacy has been weaponized to justify the walled garden environments and the clunky clean rooms that you have to execute from within if you want to get to offsite and CTV and all of those places. But there hasn't been an en masse attack on the privacy in the same way that, say, the cookie underwent an attack, and IP will undeniably go the same way over time. Right. Do I know when it'll happen and for what reason? No, because these people are massively, massively, massively better at looking deeply into the future of their strategies and when and where it will be weaponized. My personal feeling is the privacy that we've all been looking at, it's just bullshit, Vincent, right? Like, cookies were terrible identifiers. They just happened to be the currency that we transacted on, right? But they were highly unreliable. Identity providers rarely ever breach 65% in accuracy against the cookies. They almost never had, full coverage of all of the cookies and maids for a given individual or household, right? It was not that much of a privacy disrupting technology. When you consider the fact that we are handing out our biometrics to companies day in and day out, that's a privacy concern. Companies that can not only see your search behavior, but see your emails, see your location, see all of the really truly personally identifiable information and associate that with your face and your fingerprint, that's a privacy challenge. That's a national security challenge. Right? But somehow privacy has been weaponized to kill the single least efficient identifier ever to come in mass to facilitate the targeting and optimization of advertising. So sorry, you got me on a topic that I feel strongly about. And unfortunately, despite all the table banging, my answer is, I don't know. Man, I don't know where they're going to attack next. Right. But I do think that privacy right now is pushing a lot of people down to the benefit of a few people, and the ones claiming to be most protective of your privacy also happen to be benefiting the most from those privacy changes and regulation. Right. It's regulatory capture, in my opinion.
I think concentration on a personal level. The concentration of my data in the hands of one provider, when it's all encompassing of every aspect of your life, that's a far greater concern for me personally than the fact that somebody knows I bought ketchup last week. I don't think that's a hugely revealing thing, but I also think that they've had the good fortune in terms of their timing, I mean, partly in terms of the cookie decline, but just to learn from what was happening in privacy and be able to build it in a secure, privacy compliant way. I know that there is there certainly was a little bit of nervousness and cautiousness in the early days about getting everything right, getting everything in place. It does feel like it's as things stand today, it feels future proof. there'll probably be a massive scandal on the day that this goes out.
No, I think you're right. I think you're right. But I think that there are certain walls that have been put up that didn't need to be put up. Right. So, okay, I have a clean room technology, and that is where I make my data available at a granularity where you can run analytics and build targeting files, and it's completely anonymized. But I refuse to put that inventory in a third-party clean room where you can actually look across retailer at the ways where you as a merchant can look across retail at the ways in which your specific products are being purchased across retailers and understand the interconnectivity of those purchase decisions. Why not? Oh, because of privacy. But the reality is the privacy wouldn't be any different. There would be no additional risk. That's privacy driving a business decision that favors the seller of the media, in my opinion, right? I don't think it's bad intentions. I'm not even sure if they decided upon that, but it looks a lot like, a rerun of the playbook of the walled gardens that captured, I don't know what it is, like 75, 85% of ad spend before retail media popped up. It has a similar feel to it.
So when you mentioned the weaponization of privacy, for me, personally, there's lots of companies that you can look at when you talk about things like regulatory capture and weaponization of privacy. But Apple are probably the first to come to mind who I think have been weaponized. What do you think of, what's your take on Apple's strategy? I know that this sits outside our retail media conversation, but I am curious.
Well, it's problematic for me because I can sit around, sometimes talking to you in particular, Vincent, I feel like I'm just having a beer at the pub with you, right? And so we start to poke at things and see if they sound good by the end of it, right? But I have to be intellectually honest with myself. I love Apple stuff. I can't wait to get the new phone where I have, basically LLM level capabilities to interact with my phone and then the content in transactions it's a gateway to through voice. And to do that, I'm gonna have to give them all my privacy. I think Apple was very smart in their privacy strategy. It set them up beautifully for this. They are the most trusted brand in market with all of this information. I don't think anyone would dispute that. And they let the rubber hit the road where it mattered. I mean, there have been instances where they have vigorously defended the privacy of folks when the Justice Department has come knocking for the data that they like and at a certain level seem very justified to request access to by Apple, right? Like they've towed the line. Was it a strategy? Is it something that they just believe in? I don't know. I love their products though. So it's a catch-22, I suppose I could find five or six chinks in the armor that I could pick on to sound smart right here. But the minute we hang this up, I'm going to start using my iPhone. So it's a tough one. There's the convenience. There's the personalization. There's all those benefits that come with ceding some of your privacy too. Right. I don't know if I answered. Yeah.
No, it's hard to say. You can be very cynical about any large corporation, whether it's the privacy thing is a sincere belief or a strategy. But I think when you're mining cobalt in the Congo or putting up nets around your factories in China because people keep jumping out the windows, it's probably safe to say that it's a strategy.
Have you seen those videos of the cobalt? I mean, it is just brutal. It's a heartbreaking,
horrendous. I'm not in any way taking aim at you there. Every single person is probably listening on a device right now. That was where there's a high potential that cobalt was mined in the same mines. I don't think we can spend too long on that. That's a whole other podcast. So I'm curious on the privacy side of things. What do you think is the next wave that's coming?
I think IP address is already up there on the chopping block. right?
That's, yeah, yeah.
You know, I mean, I'm not a privacy expert, you know, but I know that, you know, the CCPA classified IP addresses, you know, is geolocation, and, you know, you sort of see some of the hints of it already. And I think that there's some irony to it, because IP address was kind of the mechanism for trying to figure out someone's zip code, and then you would append segmentation data to it. That was like early days targeting of media, right? We didn't get to zip four, but we could get to zip, and, you know, you'd throw shotguns and pickup trucks from Claritas on a household, and you'd allow people to buy it. Like, that literally is what the data looked like in the very, very beginning. And then we all decided that that was like the worst and most unreliable way to associate data with a household, right? And then you flip around, cookies and maids get deprecated, and everybody's talking about how wonderful IP address is as an identifier and as a mechanism for associating data and, you know, managing all of the aspects of a programmatic media buy. So it's funny. I do think it will go away. And I do think that that bodes incredibly well for retail media, where the mechanisms for modeling data, you know, in developing audiences is significantly more privacy secure. And most importantly, it's at scale, and the data is a lot more reliable and accurate. So I don't know where privacy goes. I know that so far, it's disrupted a lot of technologies, and it's cost a lot of engineering hours and maybe some businesses to shrink the changes that have occurred, but it's also arguably improved advertising, in my opinion. So it's improved the inputs. And so, you know, I think we have to look at both sides of it.
Yeah, I think you'd struggle to find many people who would disagree with you that, you know, we're on the right path and having a cleaner industry where maybe higher quality players get rewarded. So, I don't think privacy has been quite the, you know, for all, you know, you see it on Twitter every day, where Americans love to mock us in Europe for our regulations, which is often justified, often not. And but it does feel like the privacy movement is actually in some ways helping us build a better internet. Although I have to say I'm quite concerned about publishers and their fate as cookie disappears. It just looks like many of the proposed solutions aren't really going to enable many of them to sort of retain the revenues, but maybe the market will sort itself out and there'll be a flight to quality of some kind. That's what I'm hoping for. I'm curious about, you know, okay, final question, and we ask everybody this one. If you had $10 million to invest in a company or a sector, where would you invest and why? And it cannot be your own company.
Fair enough. Gosh, $10 million to invest. I guess my logic would be I would be invest in the areas that I know best. And right now, I think, you know, almost exclusively about retail media. So I'll pick a provider that I'm impressed with. It's the old Kenshu, now Sky. And I'll tell you the reason why. I don't know yet who the best in class activation platform is for retail media. But I know that Sky cuts across all the media types. They also have social. They also have search. They have all the media types that our models are saying are highly interconnected, right? And that have to be managed together, number one. And number two, they come out of ad tech. In this retail media space, there are a lot of platforms out there that are not pursuing a partnership model. They're trying to build everything. And I think that's a failing strategy. I think that at the end of the day, clients and agencies will elect to assemble their marketing technology stacks to fit their needs and their preferences. And this is a company that has an open API that invites partnership. It even partners when it's pursuing competitive solutions. And I think that those companies at the end of the day always surface to the top because those are the companies that are truly honoring the needs and the intentions of their customers, as opposed to protecting the near-term or short-term revenue generation on behalf of their own business, right? So I don't know the folks that well. This is just something I've observed, and applying that to what we witnessed, you know, with the rise of programmatic and a bunch of other stuff, the folks who win also won there also also pursued a similar strategy, right? And I'll give you one more quick example. Like LiveRamp and Neustar, if you look at sort of their identity frameworks, they not only partnered with each other, they partnered with all sorts of people and enabled all sorts of competitors, right? They allowed brands to say, hey, I want to use your identity layer, but I'm going to get my measurement over here. I'm not going to get it from you, right? And those were the ones that now TransUnion on the Neustar side, but those are the ones that surfaced to the top. And they got there by working in partnership and looking to plug into the ecosystem. And I love that Sky is a large unicorn-sized business in retail media that's planting that flag, right? Because we're seeing other pots of land that are defended very aggressively by folks hoping to build every single feature and functionality. I don't think that strategy ever wins.
I completely agree. And it's something that I very much enjoy at our events, where you have, you know, I think maybe in the early days when we started running events, you'd be slightly concerned about, oh, we've got two, you know, fierce competitors on the same panel, and how are they going to feel about that? And at this point, we're at a point where, you know, firstly, they're often like old friends, and they're as excited about meeting each other and how they can work together as much as with everyone else in the room. And there is that collaborative, collegial spirit in the industry that the smartest players seem to recognize. I do get the sense in retail media that we're not seeing it just yet, but I think that it's the wheels are in motion from what I've heard, that there's more collaboration to come. You might have inspired one final extra question there about, you know, the mood in ad tech generally. Matt Barash, who is something of an industry thought leader. He's also a sneaker aficionado and a very nice guy. But he mentioned on Twitter recently about, you know, there being a bit of a malaise in ad tech, and there's a lot of people who are a bit tired. And I'm curious about what your take is. I mean, you're obviously in one of the hotter parts of ad tech at the moment, but you've been in this for a long time. I'm curious, are you getting that sense?
Yes. Like, full stop. I'm not getting it in retail media. But yeah, I think there is a malaise, and I can't figure it out. I don't know if it's because M&A has slowed. I don't know if it's because the bar to an exit through the public markets is just so much higher, right? Like, I don't know if there's a feeling that, hey, we're kind of stuck here, and we thought at some point this company would, you know, grow through the public markets or grow through, you know, an acquisition and an integration with other solutions, or if it's just that it's at that age where its knees are a little creaky and its joints hurt a little bit more when it wakes up. But I completely agree with that statement. I didn't see that. I didn't see that tweet or whatever you call an X now. It's funny you mentioned that, because I do feel that's the case in some pockets.
It might partly be, you know, the just a reflection that, you know, the market maybe feels a little bit mature at this point, and privacy obviously is playing a role, and you know, we're seeing all things, yeah, money shift around to retail media being one of the destinations, of course. I just partly wonder, is there a little bit of a lack of imagination? I say that as somebody who doesn't know what people should be dreaming up. I know, you know, people working in funds, and they say that they're just not seeing people. They were expecting, with all the tech redundancies that we saw over the last few years, that there would be lots of people hungry, coming up with new ideas, looking to do new things. And there certainly is some, and there's some fantastic companies coming through the ranks, of course, but maybe not quite the same number of new fresh ideas that we once saw. Or
yeah.
So yeah, I'm wondering, is this inertia partly a post-pandemic thing or something? Because I felt like, yeah, the pandemic sort of fed into a bit of industry inertia in some ways. I know lots of things boomed, but equally there may be, yeah, I felt like it was around that time that you sort of started to see the malaise sit in. Are people too comfortable working at home? Or, you know, do those water cooler conversations actually count for something? I don't know what it is.
It's a really good question. The one thing that I will say, so we're clear for the listeners, I don't see that in retail media. There is a ton of enthusiasm and innovation. I see a need for the industry to continue to mature, innovate, and evolve, right? But if you step into, you know, a retail media focused conference or conversation, it feels more like ad tech of the old days, right? It's really a fun place to be right now.
Yeah, we did a Commerce Connect event at the Villa in Cannes, and it was an incredibly engaging day from start to finish. Every single session was absolutely fantastic, really engaging. Lots of candor and honesty about the issues as well, which was quite nice to see. That, you know, that there's a spirit of openness about what's going wrong as well, because that's the best path to getting things right. So, but very much it did remind me of the early days of programmatic or something like that, where you just got the sense that, yeah, people were excited about what they're building and that there was lots of runway ahead. David, it's been an absolute pleasure. And yeah, thanks so much for taking the time.
Yeah, man. Anytime. I always enjoy talking to you.
And we'll have to do this over a beer sometime, preferably in Charlotte.
Yeah.
All right. Cheers.
Thanks, bud.